Welcome to the Script and Style Show, the web show where we talk about web development with the people that make it happen. Today's episode is brought to you by TrackJS JavaScript Error Monitoring. Know when errors hit your website with the context to find and fix bugs fast with TrackJS. Start your free trial today at TrackJS.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Script and Style Show, the web show where we talk about web development and the people that make it happen. I'm Todd Gardner from TrackJS JavaScript Error Monitoring, and my co-host, David Walsh, creator of the popular blog DavidWalsh.name. How's it going today, David?
Good. How are you? It's been a few weeks, huh?
Yeah, we took a couple of weeks off for travel. You were in San Francisco. How was that?
It was good. Mozilla flies the entire team out to a single location. And when I say entire team, I mean like from around the world.
They choose San Francisco as that location. That's not cheap.
No, it's certainly not. But
it'd be a lot cheaper to fly them to Wisconsin, I think.
Half the company wouldn't show up, I think. San Francisco was nice. The weather was nice. They had, as always, really cool event set up for us. Luckily, this time we were in the same hotel, so I didn't get harassed walking in between the hotels like I did last time. But it was really good. You had some travel as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I was out in the Nordic countries for NDC Oslo in Norway. And then the wife and I stopped in Iceland on the way home, and it was cold, but it was cool. There was cool, like, geological formations and stuff to look at, and the culture's weird and interesting and fun.
Yeah.
It was fun. And then we came home, and my wife said, we got to go get a dog. So we got a dog, and now we're learning how to deal with that.
What is the arc of that decision making? Like, how do the lines fit? Or is it something that you guys have been thinking about for a long time?
Well, she has been obsessing about it for probably 6 months, and just kind of like watching the animal shelter websites for like the right one. And she's driven out to visit them like 6 times. And then 2 days ago, the right one came along. She trekked out, found it, brought it home, and it was done.
Awesome, man. Congratulations. You're a new dad.
I guess.
Dad?
Did you catch a little bit of World Cup fever?
You know, honestly, everybody was talking about it. We were in Iceland for the Iceland game, and I don't know how it ended up, but they all looked pretty disappointed. So I think they might have lost.
They didn't do well in the tournament, but we, speaking of Mozilla trips, 2 years ago, we were in London for an all-hands, and it was in the middle of the Euros. So that was a lot of fun to watch soccer while in a country that appreciates it as much as I do.
Oh, we appreciate it, but only when we're in it. If you know, the U.S. isn't in it, we could not give less of a shit about it. All right. Enough of that. We have a guest today. Who do we have as our guest?
My good friend, Daniel Buckner of Microsoft is with us today. I'm super excited to have him on. I worked with him on the MooTools team. I worked with him at Mozilla as well. And now he's a big shot at Microsoft doing forward-thinking things. Isn't that right, Daniel?
Wow, that is a lofty way to put it. But yeah, no, I work on decentralized identity. And, you know, it does integrate that buzzword blockchain at a certain layer. So, you know, that's fun and exciting, I suppose.
So Microsoft, blockchain, buzzword, kind of a big deal.
Oh, yeah, except the last part. I'm sure that's not true.
All right, so I know a little bit of this story, Mr. Buckner. Can you share with us how you got into software development?
Yeah, so, you know, I went to what I like to call the Ivy League of the West, which is Chico State.
Wait, what? The greatest
academic minds.
Chico State is the
Yeah.
I thought Chico State was like a wrestler or something.
A correctional facility.
So yeah, I'm using some liberties there. It's not a mecca of academic understanding, but I went there mostly for the parties and a business degree, I suppose. And about halfway through, you know, the technology scene really called out to me. And I was always like into tech and computers, but never programmed. And I wanted to start up a business at the time when Yelp had kind of just started. And local search, to me, in a lot of ways, was like a frontier where I saw it, you know, really expanding. And, you know, I ended up getting about $50,000 in angel funding to start this company called City Crawler, which, you know, I still have the domain to today. But it was essentially a lot of the things you see in Google Map and Foursquare and Yelp were things we had ideas about. And it was so weird, man, like putting together prototypes and stuff as a business person that never had done programming. I was really relying on the developer I was working with at some times. And, you know, I don't know that it was the first priority for them because it was, you know, we had seed funding. We were basically all just both working on equity and busy with school. So I was putting a lot to it. And, you know, I understand that someone else in that position might not be putting as much. So I didn't really understand what was being produced, you know, at the code level. And I wanted to, because, you know, it's, you feel disconnected, right? You don't want to be that non-technical co-founder.
Yeah.
Instead of just doing that, I was like, well, I better just learn. You know, so I started kind of self-teaching. I never took a class or anything, but, you know, got really involved in JavaScript. And that was kind of my gateway. It was like VueSource, like the, you know, kind of the, I don't know, the organic way to learn, and found Mutuals and really liked the concepts of OO, and just got, I guess, good enough to contribute some things to the lib. And that's kind of how it began. And I've over time, you know, skewed to where I probably do about 50% development and gone into other areas of development.
So Mutuals was the drug dealer that pushed you on the gateway drug of JavaScript.
Yeah, it was. It made sense, man. It made sense to me. And I was able to be logical in like how I thought about things versus some other libraries I won't name.
Keep it positive, man.
What other libraries? I don't know any.
No, I mean, it's well-known consonants in the alphabet, but but yeah, I was more in that camp. And David knows that. You know, we did this thing together and decided to ruin the web's prototypes as one team.
But so what are your feelings on Smush?
Smush. I think that flat is fine. I understand that it's not a verb. I get it. I mean, I just think it's if flat map works, right? Flat. I don't know. I feel like people get hung up on things.
That's our job. So one of the things that was really cool was that you introduced me to web components. You were like one of the very first people that like even brought the concept to me. And we had Max Lynch on from the Ionic framework, and they recently switched their Ionic over to using web components. What did you see in web components early on that sold you on them? When a lot of people, even to this day, web components don't really get much respect, right? People don't really use them. Like, what did you see in it early on?
Well, I mean, primarily, I think it's this common packaging format for plugins, and it's more than that, right? Like, and so I worked with the folks at Google when I was at Mozilla on, you know, the first round of specs for many years, which then, you know, even mutated further into what they are today. But I think, you know, I would posit, and this is could be totally wrong, and this is what I've always thought, is that web components provide the foundation and the packaging and hooks, like lifecycle hooks and stuff for element creation, that browsers can fast path in a native fashion, right? You can write a lot of libraries that dump a zillion divs on a page and do all this stuff and test them, but it's always going to be a moving target for browsers. Whereas if you can deliver components and start adding hooks to different things, like maybe there's paint hooks in the future and other layout things that if you're encoding them as web component classes, you'll be on the fast path. Because browsers can't generally optimize for every library out there all at once. So when you have a common target like that, I think in the future, people will find that is more easily performance optimized.
Yeah, absolutely. And then one day my heart was broken and you were away from Mozilla and landed at Microsoft, which like way back in the day was sort of like the unthinkable thing, right? You know, Mozilla was the anti- Microsoft, but Microsoft's been doing some really good stuff. And so you've joined with decentralized identity. Like, what are the components of decentralized Well, let me back up. Let me back up first. So we have this big keyword lately, blockchain, right? And I think like there was even I think it peaked as a buzzword when a company added blockchain to their name and their stock rose like whatever percent. It was ridiculous.
Wait, you think it's peaked?
It was peak ridiculous, that's for sure.
it was definitely a high moment. I think we have not blockchain.
Well, that's yet to be seen. But let's like taking a step back, we hear about blockchain a lot, most with cryptocurrency. Just for like the layman, can you describe what exactly blockchain is and I guess what some of its usages and advantages are?
If I had to just touch on a couple of quick points, blockchain does actually do something technically interesting, which is it solves some pretty old coordination problems, technical coordination problems, the Byzantine generals problem, understanding how to align on essentially a deterministic or objective set of transactions across a substrate where you could have bad actors in the midst, right? But still able to align accurately on one history. And so we just haven't had good tech for that in the past, not to do it in a way that's trustless like it is, for things like Bitcoin. I think it remains to be seen how absolutely useful it is outside of like truly decentralized instructions, just because, a lot of the things that you would want out of it, you lose when you move to private versions of this stuff. So I think that there's a ton of hype around all of it, with tokens and all that stuff. And there's really like a few use cases that absolutely make sense. And then there's the vast majority that don't.
Where does it make sense?
I really think that money, because of the properties of money and DPKI, which is the foundations of digital identity, are primarily some things that run really well on these systems because they hit on exactly what's necessary, which is, a shared linearized global state, the ability to own something that's backed by strong cryptography, but yet is in an index that's shared, which is, really what you want for like a DPKI system. So people can manage keys and have like a global view of something that's knowable. I was working on these concepts even at Mozilla. It's funny because it started back at Mozilla in about 2011, 2012, when Aaron Schar, who introduced me to Bitcoin in 2011. And then, I started talking about it everywhere and people just unfollow me because of it. but it started there. It's called Firefox Handshake. And we had the concept early on, just very rudimentary, like, hey, Bitcoins, you can use the op return to color a coin, right? And colored coins, that basic idea was out there. And, I had skipped past that complexity and thought, okay, I'll color some random value in the colored coin. That thing's going to be the root of my identity. And then all the transactions I do afterward and keys are linked to that. And what we wanted to do at Mozilla with Firefox Handshake in the midst of Firefox OS, which kind of sucked all the company's resources,
right,
crowded out some of these other efforts. Like we won our business plan competition, all that stuff, but it was around decentralized apps. That's really what we were trying to do is, how do you really have decentralized apps if you're reliant on a CA system that's owned, if your code is the keys that sign your code are just randomly somewhere. You're kind of always relying on someone. So this was the ability to say there's this system out there and you can rely on and identify and sign things. So when we apply blockchain to, and I'll skip money, to identity, we're actually using it for the primitives that in blockchain that you see in like Bitcoin. And I would actually posit to the audience that Bitcoin isn't even money, right? Like money is a construct. It's something that we as humans come up with, right? Like what Bitcoin really is provable trading of ownership over a record that's out there in the shared database. It just so happens it has these other properties of scarcity and things like that. And people value that. And that's what they're trading off of. And that gives rise to its monetary value, right?
Right.
But at its core, it's just a really good DPKI and addressing system, right? That's what it was on day one. Before any coin had any value, it was a pretty darn good DPKI system. So we use it for that property, the ability to create an identifier that isn't assigned to you by, a company or government or anyone like that. You kind of self-create, and then you own and control by virtue of ownership and control of the keys that back it.
So you mentioned a few areas where blockchain would be useful, but you said the vast majority aren't. Have you seen any of those types of businesses or organizations trying to use, like, what's an example where blockchain just doesn't fit?
So I'll give you a class that is broadly applicable, but use one example of it, which is like tangible property. So saying that tangible assets are ownership represented by tokens on a blockchain is, in my opinion, dubious for a lot of reasons, right? And I've outlined this before, but just to use a house as an example, right? If my ownership of my house is these private keys, right? Think about what that really means, right? Today, if someone steals my house keys, they don't gain legal ownership over my house. Like, they don't show up one day and they sign a digital transaction. like, we're going to bounce you out of here. I called the cops. It's like that would be nonsense banana pants. So the idea that you're going to say, well, you know, I have this token that owns my house and I'm going to shield these keys. And like, if someone gets in there, it's immutably gone from my hands. And, you know, what recourse do I have? I go to the cops and they're like, well, he stole your keys fair and square, sir. It's silly, right? And then even so, like, even if you did try to create a token, the whole idea of property and a transfer like that has to be backed by some authority. Now, I'm a libertarian, so I don't necessarily believe it has to be a large, giant government structure, but it's got to be some authority, or else, like, who's going to ever say that you were the person that owned the house, or that they're going to defend that with the law? And in that sense, the creation of the token at birth needs to be bestowed with who is that, right? Which token stands for 123 Main Street? Somebody's going to assign that. Someone's going to say my plot of land equals this token. And so from inception, if you have an authority doing that, and you know you don't want immutability, because if someone steals something, you want to be able to reset it, you kind of don't want a blockchain, because that's like the very premise. Yeah. So I think there's a lot of areas like that in tokenization that I just find how to do.
So what are the limitations that we're looking at with blockchain right now? Like, what are the problems that we're still facing in trying to adopt this, more of this tech?
You know, I think the biggest one that everyone kind of just points out right away is performance and scale. People look at things like Bitcoin, this, wow, you know, it's going single digits or low double digit, you know, transaction per second rates. And that's kind of the norm in UTXO style chains like forks of Bitcoin and across the ecosystem. And, you know, you get some more, you know, not truly decentralized chains like a Ripple or, you know, other things like that claim to have higher transaction capacities. But for our uses, I kind of look at all of these like, you know, some other non-decentralized chains or more centralized chains claim like thousands or maybe even tens of thousands of transactions per second. And how we view that in terms of decentralized identity and what capacity would be necessary is like, it's like the slow, is like the fastest snail. It's just a snail race. And like one snail happens to be going like ever so faster than the other snail. So it's just not interesting, because when in terms of DPKI, and like, if you think about an identity system supporting billions of people, tens or hundreds of billions of devices, like, you know, things across the ecosystem, virtual identities of like virtual objects and everything, the load of that would be in the hundreds of thousands to maybe even millions of transactions per second. So it's not interesting to me that someone says, well, I can do 1,000 transactions per second. I'm like, well, you know, that's cute, but we need to get further along. So that's the big one. And I think you're starting to see people recognize that. They obviously have known about it for a while. And there's solutions coming out for different use cases. One big one to highlight is like Lightning Network on Bitcoin. What they're basically doing is saying, well, if you lock value on the actual slow chain layer, which is, you know, always relatively slow, you can do these signed commits, like basically signatures off chain, that are as fast as the network will run, you know, and as your CPU can sign something and transfer it to a peer. And that way you kind of liberate most of the performance and scale issues by going to that second level, just using the chain for its root of trust. And that's exactly what we do for decentralized identity as well.
Haven't you destroyed some of the core benefit of the chain if you've gone outside of the chain for performance, though?
No, actually.
Like, so, aren't you trusting that layer?
You're actually not really, right? Like in Lightning's construct, you're locking value, and you're basically signing what amounts to be like variables for an input, right? You're just not putting them back on the chain. You're signing these variables and you're saying, I could walk back and I could put them on the chain at any time, right? And they would execute, but I'm just going to keep doing this transfer until I'm done, right? It's almost like a nonce that just keeps counting up. And then whenever you want to settle, you can settle out. So there's a little bit of, like software trust on the outside for things, but it's not like some people blow it out of proportion. It's the same thing for decentralized identity layer twos. We're basically rooting an identifier in aggregate. Like just think about, you know, one system that we're working on. Inside of one transaction, we'll root a hash, and that hash links out to a secondary storage layer that's not centralized, so decentralized storage layer. And that contains, you know, potentially hundreds of thousands of operations of like creations of identities, of updates to their keys, other things like that. And because it's in the chain, right, because you're inserting it into a transaction, you're actually still using the chain for its one really important identity purpose, which is a linear chronological history and shared state, right? And that's really what you need in DPKI, because you got to understand at what point were these keys associated with this ID and did they drop off? And for that, you just really need, you know, that trusted linear chronology.
So let's dive deeper into decentralized identity. So like, walk me through, like, pretend I'm an idiot. What does it mean? What are we doing? Why would I need a decentralized identity versus, you know, Active Directory or LDAP server or something?
Yeah, so people ask this question a lot. And a lot of people, you know, there's another term with decentralized identity that gets thrown around called self-sovereign identity, which people just lose their minds over. You know, they hear the word sovereign. So many people associate that with the government. And they say, wow, you can't be self-sovereign, right? It's not like I get to go mint my driver's license. Like, I can't just be like, today I have this ability, or I'm starting a business. I don't need this business license, even though the government says I do. Decentralized identity is not saying like there is no trust in the world. It's saying that identities can be represented digitally in a way that you can own for the first time. So you own basically just an identifier, like kind of like an email address today. Like right today, if you went and got an outlook.com address or a Gmail address or whatever, that's an identifier in the world. But you know, those companies, they could eliminate your email address for whatever reason, like your Facebook ID, people get taken off Facebook, right, and eliminated. They could shut that down. They could go out of business, right? And essentially, the identifier, which is the root of, you know, your identification to the world anyway, can be gone. So it's not a viable substrate to like have your driver's license tied to like your email. Right, because if your email goes away, that means what happened to your driver's license? You need something that you own and control, and it can't just be taken away from you arbitrarily. So what you start out with decentralized identity is just an identifier. It has no history, no provenance, nothing. It's empty, right? And so think about DIDs as a big flat thing. There's no hierarchy. Like every DID is equal when it starts life. But certain DIDs, like say the DMV went and got their own DID, become recognized. It's not unlike the CA system. It just is not a hierarchy of trust. They become a recognized ID and people say, hey, that's the DMV's ID, right? So when it uses its keys to sign a thing that stands for a digital driver's license, that carries weight in the world. People look at it and say, I know where that signature came from. It came from the DMV's DID. So we're not with decentralized identity saying there isn't any authorities or any trust in the world. We're giving everyone a cell phone foundation to create those trust relationships more easily.
Okay, so where does privacy come into this? Does everything have to be public? Are there pieces of it that are private? Like, where's the privacy in this?
That's a fantastic question. So, you know, you think about these IDs, right? And people are already being tracked and fingerprinted all across the internet based on cookies and other things that identify them in certain ways. One thing to remember is people aren't limited to just one DID, right? A DID is a construct you can create, almost like you create an email address. You can create multiple DIDs and have like one per context, right? I might have one or two main DIDs that are my persona, my public persona, and I'm willing to maybe attach things I would put on LinkedIn or whatever to it, because those are things I'm comfortable being public. But there's other IDs where I might engage with a website or an app or someone else, and I generate what's called a pairwise identifier, just a DID that I just give to them and I don't use for anything else. And that way there's no correlation, right? I'm just using it with them. I'm just signing the keys that tie to it to do things with that other party. And in that way, it becomes sort of this relational thing where you can give IDs out to one or multiple or groups, and they just know you as that sort of version of yourself. And so one other thing to highlight privacy is that what we basically use the chain for is rooting the state of a couple important values. One is the public keys that are associated with your ID at any given time, so that someone can look your ID up and say, hey, I know how to challenge you to check if you own this thing, right? I can sign you a challenge with these public keys. And if you're you can. The other big one is service pointers. So the chain doesn't store any data. There's no biometric, nothing that's PII is on the chain. All of those are at off-chain locations, regular traditional servers, where you would sign and encrypt data, or just encrypt if you wanted to, or put plain text. You put it out there on that server, what we call identity hubs, and that's where it lives. So someone essentially looks up your ID, finds a link to these personal data stores, and that's where they start asking actual identity questions. And none of that is public if you don't want it to be. You can encrypt everything. So even though it might like reside on a Microsoft server or some other server, you're encrypting it from your device and pushing it out there. So, you know, even if Microsoft, like say we were breached or something, all they're getting is encrypted data, right? So that's kind of how the privacy linkage works.
So this sounds a little similar to the Mozilla Persona project I heard about a while ago. Were you involved with that? Was that kind of a similar thing, or am I way off base there?
I didn't work on that. Like, I didn't personally work on that. That was still kind of juggling through Federation and other. There was some there were ties to federated systems and things that weren't, I would say, qualified as decentralized identity or self-sovereign identity. And one big part of self-sovereign identity or centralized identity is that there's one index, right? I know where to go to at least find all the IDs. I could find them. It doesn't mean that I know who they attach to or what, you know, is it a device? Is it a person? Or I get any of their data, but I have this big, you know, white pages essentially, right? With a phone number. And so I look the ID up, I can call the phone number.
Where is this index? Where does this index live?
So just think of the chain as like, it has these roots of IDs, and there's this thing called the universal resolver. In traditional speak, it would be equivalent to DNS bind, where you provide it a DNS name to resolve, and it's going to give you locations to go find it. Same sort of thing. That's what the universal resolver is. So it takes DIDs that might be rooted in certain systems like Bitcoin or Ethereum or Sovereign or whatever, and it has a module inside for each one to go and locate the ID, find the associated metadata, the key information, you know, the service pointers, and then return it to you as the developer. So you can kind of, you know, you have this white pages, you can do this lookup. And that's super important because none of the other systems we've had have ever really had that globalized index of ID.
So this requires like a public infrastructure similar to DNS for it to work, where a number of different root level organizations mm-hmm. run clones of each other's indexes and synchronize with each other and that sort of thing.
So I think that the interesting point here is that there is really truly only one deterministic index. The chain is the root of that, and that is a linearized history that is, I wouldn't say trustless, but trust minimized. So that's absolutely deterministic. How the layer two nodes that a lot of these companies and like we're developing and we're going to be open sourcing, how they basically do this is they'll run a node that reads the chain kind of from zero and finds all these transactions that happen to be encoded such a way that, you know, have IDs within them. And then they form the name state. So it's not like a consensus system. It doesn't, everyone can get the same name state just by running basically a little server that parses it correctly, that follows the rules and outputs this, you know, this view of the world basically. And it's, there's some self-incentivization there because you could always not follow the rules and you could, you know, follow the chain inaccurately, but you're going to end up with a different white pages and you're not going to be able to call anyone. It's going to be kind of useless, right? So there's a natural convergence there where people don't just deviate. It's just like, you know, all the blockchains themselves. If you make blocks that don't adhere to whatever the rules are, they're just going to get rejected.
So earlier, we were talking about a use case that didn't work for blockchain, and you were using your house, a piece of physical real estate property, as your example, because you don't want somebody to just steal your key and now I own your house and there's nothing you can do about it. What's to stop me from stealing your key and now I own you? I've identity stolen you and there's nothing you can do about it.
So there are recovery means that we're working on actively right now that are that bring key management closer to the human, that make it feasible to self-recover and do so without a centralized authority. Some of the schemes involve some custodial trust. If you want to opt into that as a user, there's a lot of variability in how you can set up your recovery means. The natural question might be, well, why don't I just steal your identity for your human, you know, your human representation of identity? And the answer to that is kind of a game theory question. Do you want to be guarding the private keys of 20,000 things or one thing that can sign authoritatively over many things? Humans are just sometimes pretty dreadful at like managing, you know, large corpuses of things like that. But people shield their certain aspects of their identity fiercely. I mean, people are programmed not to give their social security card out, right? But everyone knows social security. If you still went up and asked people, hey, you know what? There's this big breach. I don't know if you heard about it, called Equifax, and social security information is already out there. Can I see your social security card? They would probably still be reluctant to give it to you because of decades of conditioning, right? And so that's the game theory aspect of that. And to tie it into the property thing, I don't want to say there's no solution. I want to offer one. And that is to think about sort of this red pill, blue pill idea with blockchain. You could either try and go all on chain and do all these crazy token things that are probably never going to scale, or you could see things through the lens of identity. When I look at property, what does that look like in an identity construct? Well, I think it looks a lot like this. You know, maybe the bank has a DID and the seller and buyer have a DID and the title company does, and so does the government registrar in the area. And how do I prove that I own, you know, a piece of property? Well, we all take our keys together and we sign an attestation, an assertion that we all signed with all our keys that anyone can verify and say, hey, these were the parties to this attestation. And we basically have it as a bearer proof, right? It's not something that if you steal it, you own the thing. It's a proof of who owns the thing, which is a subtle difference, but there's a lot of implications. One is that you can do that all off chain. So it's instant, right? It's just a bunch of people signing a piece of data, which is simple. Two, you can store it and replicate it anywhere. And it's not like private keys because you don't really care if someone grabs it. That's almost like saying, well, I printed 50 copies of my deed that say it's mine. And like someone stole the deed and it says it's mine. So I don't know what they stole, right? Other than proof that it's mine. So I think that it's a better architecture. If you really examine identity, and this is like kind of the head trip, right, that you have to get into, is it's a bit like it kind of consumes everything. It's everything in the universe, like everything we do. Like we're talking right now over a medium that secures us by identity, right? Like somewhere along the line, there's a private key standing somewhere. We know because it's attached to an account that I'm talking to you. You know, anything I really do in the physical world, like buying a car, it's all identity exchange. There might be some money involved, but it's a handshake. It's people signing things. It's these occurrences. So I actually liken identity itself to one theory in physics. I don't know if you're familiar with like dark matter theory, but basically dark matter theory says, hey, you know, what you see in the world, like this laptop in front of you and everything, that's like only 5% of the matter in the world. But you think as a human, like that's the world, right? That's what drives the world is what I see. But really there's like this 95% of just unseen, right? That is all around you, that's interacting constantly with everything around you. And that makes up the bulk of the world. And that is what I would assert to you identity is. It's this thing that we don't really think about, but it's latently driving almost every interaction in our daily lives. And so for the first time, decentralized identity in this global index gives you the ability to make sense of that in a more, you know, feasible and quantifiable way.
So what is the ideal situation? Where does decentralized identity get us?
Wait, and in what facet do you mean?
Like, let's say all of your work goes great and people start adapting it. What is the end goal? Is it to replace, like, for example, hospitals have their own private records, right? They have private records here. The library has private records about you. Equifax is giving people your private records. Are we tying all of these things, medical records, library records, into this one big decentralized identity system? Or is each hospital going to have their own decentralized identity? Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, is it a massive global everything is my identity, or am I going to have one over here, one over here?
So you know, Mozilla came up with this line a long time ago. It was one of the videos I really used to love. And it was like, you know, your browser should answer to no one but you. I don't know if you were there at the time the video was put out, but I mean, really, that's what identity is. Your identity should answer to no one but you. You own it. Microsoft doesn't own it. Google certainly doesn't own it. Equifax sure as shit shouldn't own it. No one should own it but you. So your medical records should be in your encrypted personal data store. A lot of your financial information should be in your encrypted personal data store. These things should be under your control and they should be highly secure. And so I think in terms of core identity, which I term those things core identity, like things that people traditionally think of identity as identity information, I hope it brings a radical level of security and trust that is harder to hack, harder to breach, and interactions between entities become trusted. Now, you brought up, do the hospitals have their own ID? Absolutely. I think everything in the system has its own ID, right? And it becomes known for its ID and things it signs, like your doctor is going to sign, like your script right now is analog, right? They sign this piece of paper and that's how you get your pills that you need to survive, right? Future, your doctor might have a DID and they sign that with their keys and then you bring it to, you know, the pharmacy. They're all running on that same identity substrate and they can recognize who that signature is and say, oh yeah, that's Dr. Bill. You know, I'm going to find a prescription, right? Because he has some other attestations, some signatures from his, where he graduated from medical school and that he's a board licensed, you know, all these things. And they can check all those attestations on the fly in seconds and understand that he's a real, you know, he's the real deal. So that's where it does it for core identity. But I know you're a development podcast, so I think we should probably, you know, it'd be nice to bring it back to like what do app developers care about.
Let's go. And
this is where decentralized identity takes a turn from core identity to really being a substrate for apps and services. So if you think about what we could do with decentralized identity, consider a future where an application is delivered to the client and the application is backed by a DID. Just like an app has, you know, a domain today, it has its own ID, that this app, right? And the code that is sent to your device is signed by that application. And this is not unlike today where, you know, there's the Android APK signing. If you're in the Play Store and you got a signed APK, you have these abilities. If you're not, you have these other ones, right? Instead of saying you need to be in that centralized trust silo and it's the only place you can have signed code, we're basically giving apps, which are just nouns, they're just an identity, the ability to say, this is, you know, version 1.3 of me, right? So if I pull that down and put it in, say, like a PWA with some special CSP, you know, additions maybe for DIDs, I can execute code, right? And here's the cool part. This is true serverless, right? We talk about Firebase and like Amazon serverless. What if you could write an app and that executed locally on the user's device? And instead of asking for whatever pass system you're using to store, like Firebase or whatever, you ask for access to the user's decentralized identity data store. You say, hey, I want to be able to store to like the music playlist section of your data or the music recording section. And it scopes the access to that particular piece of data. And the application doesn't have to worry about where it's going. Like my identity data store could be on Azure, someone else's could be on AWS, another could be on Spider Oak or like at their house. But the API inside the browser might be like navigator.did.store, right? Where the developer just calls that API and just like asking for your geolocation, it pops up and says, hey, looks like this person wants to store some, you know, some music playlist data to your identity data store. Would you like to allow that? And you say, yeah, sure. Sign them a permission against that DID. And now they can communicate with that data store over a shared API that all of those standardized data stores reflect. So I think that is the true serverless app future. Instead of relying on a pass that's rooted on one, you know, infrastructure for one provider, you don't have to care about providers. That goes away.
isn't there still like some ownership? I mean, it's decentralized in terms of implementation, but there's got to be like a standard for everybody to like communicate with. Like, here's how we're going to do this thing. And mm-hmm. who owns that? Somebody like some organization somewhere will say, this is distributed identity version 1.1, you know, the ECMA version of this thing or whatever. Yeah. Like,
absolutely.
What do you envision the organization is behind this?
So absolutely. Great question. There's actually, so the DID spec, the thing that basically describes the metadata document that contains keys and like how you specify that, the JSON-LD doc, that is already in a W3C community group. And so I can link your viewers to that maybe whenever, you know, after the show. But it's called DID, Decentralized Identifiers. It's a W3C credentials community group specification. It's been under development for almost, I want to say 3 years. And it's pretty well fleshed out. So we're hoping that moves through W3C. And that's one piece of the puzzle. The other big piece, because that gives you the identifiers and like keys and endpoints, is once you've standardized that format and you have this endpoint, well, what does it point to, right? Like I said, most of the action happens off-chain with these data stores. So you need to have, you don't want to have 50 different APIs for 50 different types of data store. So we are actively pursuing, I wouldn't call DIF, Decentralized Identity Foundation, a SDO like W3C. It's not trying to be that. It's more of like an industry open source standards group that Microsoft's a part of, IBM is a part of, Accenture, RSA, a bunch of folks at identity.foundation. And we're putting together what we hope could be possibly a data store standard so that you can ask for those playlists in a common way, so that you can ask for the permissions to write to, you know, financial records in a common way. And once with those two pieces, we've got, you know, that's like 80% right there. Right. So those are really, really important. And Microsoft is diligently working to not only make sure those are out there and we can try and align as a community, but put open source reference implementations of the data store and other bits out there so that anyone can run them. You don't have to run them on Azure. It's for you to decide. Maybe you don't even trust a provider. You want to run it at home on like a static IP or something. That's all you. And we want to make sure that that is in the community's hands and that, you know, you can take control of your identity.
What is the incentive for like a software vendor to implement this versus just the walled garden approach that, you know, the Apple, Google, and Microsoft have right now, where they have a ton of advantage of, you know, Google being the one who owns your Google identity and everybody uses their Google identity to log into everybody. And, you know, to a lesser extent, Microsoft has the same thing with Live and Apple has the same thing with theirs. Like, yeah. What, why would they switch? Why would they change?
It's a good question. It's a good question. So I would say that there is a graduated scale of how much those companies rely on owning you. And I will let you place them on that scale in your own mind, but think about Microsoft in relation to, there's really only five companies in the world, I believe, that could do this, right? That could, just because they're large, they've got the platforms, they're integrated, they've got stacks and everything. Like, it's not to put down or belittle any startup, because we work with some of the most amazing people in the community who work at startups and everything. But the reason why I want to do this at Microsoft is because I see it like, you know, browser, you probably need a browser, you probably need some hooks, right? To be able to try and introduce this to people. Not all of those big five companies that participate and have all those sort of chess pieces are all incentivized to give the user back control of their life. It just so happens that Microsoft is highly diversified. So, you know, well, I guess relative to some other ones. So just think about what that means in that context and why we might not be adverse to doing something like that while others might be.
So where are we in the development of decentralized identity? You mentioned that you're trying to push things through W3C, which is awesome. Where is it at Microsoft? And how do you think it will be eventually rolled out? Like, is it going to be phones? Am I going to be able to use this on Xbox, the PC? Like, where are we and where's it going?
So I think there's a couple primary things, right? We talked about a few of them. We you talked about a way to get your identifier, talked about a data store that you need to have. And they replicate, by the way, I should say that the data stores, you don't just pick one provider, you can have multiple instances. It's kind of like a personal mesh. So you might want one at home that replicates with your cloud one. And the reason you want a cloud one is for availability, right? So they're a ring. But the other thing you need is user agents. So just like we call a browser a user agent, we think that there's going to be user agents for your identifiers and identity, things that help you do key management, that sign on your behalf, right? That can do these as you direct them. So I think that you're going to see, you know, there'll be an app for desktop, or you know, maybe it's browser integrated, or maybe you'll have, you know, a mobile phone app. I think all of those are viable client type devices that could have user agents that help you go fetch content, visualize it, all of those things. One big one is, I'll just give you an example, right? And I've actually written an extension, you know, a little test extension that does this, but because you can use your white pages to look up that phone number and then go to someone's data store, there's this endpoint for getting a profile, like a profile people, you know, want to be public, whatever they want to be public, they put out there. And I wrote a little extension that basically takes a DID, looks it up and says, hey, give me the profile data. And through a Chrome embedded page, you know, something that's inside the extension, it renders what looks a heck of a lot like a social networking page, right? It's got your picture, takes whatever data you were willing to give it from the profile on the data store and renders it out. And now I can just look people up, right? I can just see stuff they want to make public. Maybe they want to make some pictures public. Maybe they want to make some posts public. I don't know, but that might be the role of a user agent that's integrated into the browser.
So I think what you've described sounds really, really, really awesome. How do we get people to adopt this? Right? Like how do you get a non-tech savvy person to adopt this? You know, like everybody signs into stuff with Facebook because it's a cute thing that they see their grandkids or their friends' kids on and stuff. And that's very incentivizing to use Facebook. How can we get people on board with this who, again, aren't very tech savvy?
So I think there's going to be a lot of on-ramps. I think the less tech savvy people, there's a range of concerns for every type of demographic. The less tech savvy people probably need a user agent that can make key management dead simple, right? Recovery dead simple. You know, we can't be asking a grandma to go print out a QR code so she can store a Bitcoin under her pillow or something. It's just not going to buy. So we've got to come up with methods that are better than that. And we're working on that. Some other ways that we can do it is, you know, entice developers to get on board with an app ecosystem that they truly own, right? Self-publishing in the truest absolute sense is something that developers, and I know we at Mozilla, when I was there, sought this for a long, long time. And other ways are for normal people is to get it integrated in their life in ways that help them. So here's another browser integration, right? That you might say, I just want that because this helps me. You go to a site that sells beer, and it's such a farce, right? Oh, tell me your age. And you get like a kid. Yeah, you know, I'm 47 and they're like 12. And so the government, I don't know what they're thinking they're actually doing, but it certainly isn't anything effective. But it's enough to annoy you every time you want to go to the website. I mean, what if your browser, your user agent, you could say, look, in a trustless way, with a zero knowledge proof is what we call them, just deliver to that website proof that I am over 21. You don't even have to say your age, just proof that I'm over 21. And that proof might be signed by a government agency or some other trusted agent, like your, you know, some of the fiduciary duty institutions can actually sign digital representations of your ID, your driver's license. So we could have that be the onboard where it says, hey, you don't want to be nagged in your browser anymore when certain basic stuff comes up, get one of these, you know, have a better experience, like deliver actual value to people. And so, you know, I don't want to talk about the ways that Microsoft, you know, obviously it's a large company. You know, we happen to run the vast majority of enterprise identity for the world. So, you know, there's ways that I think we can help people adopt because we can say, you know, we vetted this, we looked at this, it's great. We're working on it. And at some point we think it's really going to be, you know, pretty awesome for your organization. And so there's ways we can bring that to the fore. I don't have to go into those. You could probably surmise in your head, like,
is there somewhere developers who are watching today could go to start hacking?
Yeah, so Decentralized Identity Foundation is where Microsoft and all these other companies that are really interested in this and share this vision for decentralized identity are gathering to we've been in design phases with a lot of these specs and ideas for a long, long time, you know, like about a year. And we're right now, Microsoft certainly and other organizations in various channels within DIF is starting to actually land code. And so those repos, decentralized-identity is the GitHub username or org name. And those repos are going to be the place to look. And, you know, there's not a ton there right now, but there's going to be a lot landing over the next few months. That I can say with absolute assurance, just from our side. So, and all of it's open source, Apache 2. We have the same patent policy that W3C has to the letter. We actually use theirs. So all of this is intended to be unencumbered. And Microsoft's going to be making some really awesome announcements about giving some things to the community, both open source code and other types of grants that I think people are going to be pretty excited about.
I just thought of one really geeky question. I don't know how to ask it. So Vinnie Lingham has a civic token, and that was being sold as sort of a decentralized identity. How do they relate, if at all, or am I crazy?
So Civic is a member of DIF, just to start. So they actually are a member of DIF. Without really going into any of the token models, I would just say those token models, I can't name the number of companies or organizations in DIF that have tokens or use them, but there's a few. And that's within their view of the ecosystem or within their lens, they can use monetization measures they think would be successful. And that's something that, you know, I think people should feel free to explore. Supplying a token, I can't speak to like how effective all that stuff's going to be. It's kind of early stages, but you know, that's up to them. Basically.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Sorry. Yeah. So this got deep. I don't know. It's like a deep podcast.
No, it's really good stuff. Todd, did you have any more questions?
I have one more. It's varying back out of the tech realm back into that. Is a lot of the use cases that have been really compelling to me as you've been describing this all involve going back to a trusted like government or large organization authority, like saying that, you know, I am over 21. Like I would need, you know, a government probably to say like, this is my identity. Here's my birth certificate. Here's when I was born, or a DMV or something like that. So are any governments or like governments involved in this to make that happen?
There are actually a few governments that are involved. One of the absolute best in terms of thought leadership and tech, I mean, these guys blow me out of the water all the time, is the folks from British Columbia, the Canadian province. They're forward thinking. They deliver code, smart folks. And John Jordan over there in BC is the guy that we work with in DIF. Just really amazing folks. And they're looking at this as like, hey, why don't we sign claims for users? Why would we not do that? Why would we not provide a digital means and bring that in the 21st century? Because email, you know, we don't send snail mail ever. Like, this is ludicrous. So there are governments getting involved. But the other thing to understand is there's all sorts of other types of proofs that are used in the world that are not government related. Like AML KYC might be a regulation government has in some countries, but if I wanted to prove that I, you know, could trade on some market or something, it's my bank saying that I have over $100,000, you know, liquid, that you don't got to go to a government for that. You go to a bank. Mm. Right? And so all these other sorts of attestations that are exchanged between individuals that can be there if they have a way to form them. So I think what we think of as proofs in the world will expand, and we don't have it today simply because individuals really don't have a great way to construct proofs, right? They just don't have a way to do that today.
So let me chain that over. Mm-hmm. Banks is a good point. Banks know a mm-hmm. lot about you. Banks can, they're, you know, their whole business is around trust in a mm-hmm. way. Are banks on board with this? Are any banks talking with you about adding these sort of signing capabilities?
We are talking with some of the largest financial companies in the world about this, and they're bullish on it for a number of reasons. I mean, you have the legislation coming out of the EU, with GDPR and other things that are sort of turning private data into a toxic asset, right? They're holding a toxic liability on their books. And if they can get the same intelligence from you to say, hey, I want to do a credit score, so I don't need to even see your data. I want to ship you an algorithm, and it executes within your data store in a trusted enclave that we don't actually ever export the raw data. We just want the answer, right? We want to know if you could trade on this market. That's what we want, is that Boolean true or false. They would love to move to a model where they don't have to have that liability. So yes, absolutely. We are talking to a number of them.
Awesome. That's really cool. I like that. That's all I have. David, anything else from you?
No, let's jump into takeaways. What's your big takeaway today, Todd?
My big takeaway is that this was farther along than I thought it was when I first heard about it. Like, as when we started this conversation, it sounded like a good idea in principle, but like there were so many organizational hurdles that it seemed kind of like science fiction. And then as we've talked about it, and like more companies are on board, and like, you know, there's already standards, there's already committees, there's already like governments starting to do things. This seems far more realistic and plausible, like it might happen, than I thought it was. I think that's very cool. What about you, David?
I think that when I look back at knowing Dan, he's really made me think about things in different ways. The first one, of course, being when I first met him in person, I was working at SitePen, and I was doing like a dojo training course. And he's like, you should come to Mozilla. And I was like, I'm not smart enough to come there. He's like, yeah, you should really come. And that gave me confidence when I did interview at Mozilla to get the job. So thank you for that. But one of the biggest things has always been crypto, right?
Mm-hmm.
Dan was very bullish on Bitcoin. And I tried to throw everything at him to be the person that said no. I was like, well, people can just hack it. And Dan's like, well, people can hack your bank account. And I'm like, well, people can pump a coin. Well, people do that in the stock market. Like everything I came at with him, he hit me back. And of course, now with decentralized identity, and we already talked about web components way back in the day. So I've really appreciated Dan's forward thinking in our friendship. And I really look forward to seeing what we're able to roll out here. Dan, did you have any takeaways for today?
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm excited as we do this to start talking to more individuals and groups and outlets like this, because at the end of the day, like you both correctly identified, getting this into the hands of people is the turtle. And through things like this, where we can touch base with developers and say, hey, it's coming, and we're going to try to do it the right way. These are the most important engagements I think we can have. And I'm really just appreciative that I was able to discuss these things at this depth. And I'm not appreciative that you haven't invited me out to Madison so I could see these four fireplaces. I really need to see it.
Well, if Bitcoin hits 10K again, you'll be out here, right?
Yeah, definitely. I have to put the fireplace thing in.
All right. Well, so that was our takeaways. Anything else you want to plug before we wrap it up?
No, I really want to thank you guys. Dave's been one of my like good friends forever, and just super appreciative of the time. And just if you want to look for more identity.foundation, DIFF, all the open source stuff that's coming out, get involved in W3C and these channels. And it's going to take us all, because no one owns identity, only you should own it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I think it's been a great show. We went, a full hour, which obviously means it's been a great conversation. We'll be back next week with a new topic that we've yet to determine, but I don't believe either of us are on vacation, so we'll probably be doing a show next Thursday. Until then, we'll catch you later. The Script and Style Show is recorded and produced by David Walsh and Todd Gardner. We'll see you next time on Script and Style.